Good morning, and welcome to the October 28th edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman, here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger.
This morning on Mountain Money, we're going to start by speaking with author Sarah Bronin. She's going to talk about her new book, Key to the City, How Zoning Shapes Our World.
Then we'll be speaking with Mary Gwen Valenga about Rise Boxing and a very special class they have over there. We'll finish up the hour with Robert Holmes of Park City Storage and Drew Munson of Aberdeen Management and Development with a discussion about storage. Affordable housing presents one of the most persistent problems facing American towns and cities. One major force driving both the lack of existing affordable housing and the difficulty in creating more is zoning. Author Sarah Bronin takes on the challenge. Author Sarah Bronin takes on the challenge of explaining both how we got here and how things could change for the better in her new book, Key to the City, How Zoning Shapes Our World. We're lucky to be joined by her this morning. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Kevin.
So what motivated you to write the book, and how long did it take to do all the research?
I'd say the research is a lifelong effort and fascination with the cities. I mean, I'm a professor. I work on land use issues and property and zoning and historic preservation law and all of that. So I really was very happy to be able to draw from some of the things that I've learned in the past, some of the places I've visited, and some of the experience I've had as chair of the City of Hartford's Planning and Zoning Commission. And I really wrote this book because, especially in that role as the volunteer chair of the Connecticut Capital Cities Zoning Commission, I realized that people really didn't have a full grasp about how zoning works. And as a law professor, I had, you know, at least how zoning works on paper and what the litigation about zoning has been, you know, how zoning codes compare to each other. But I think the people who are governed by zoning codes, which is basically almost every American in the country, they didn't really have that understanding. And so the book is really to try to translate this super arcane area of law for everybody.
And I want to ask you about your experiences in Hartford. But first, can we do a little bit of sort of overview? Can you share a bit about the history of zoning in this country?
So zoning really developed, let's say, a century ago, a little before that. The first city zoning ordinance that we would recognize as zoning today was in New York City in, I think, 1916. And people looked at what New York City had done and said, hey, that's a great idea. We should adopt zoning in our town. And so you saw cities kind of start with zoning. You saw the federal government play a role in the 1920s in developing a standard state rule, state statute that then all the state legislatures adopted, that then in turn gave local governments the powers to zone. So you had, over the course of, let's say, the first half of the 20th century, communities all over the country, cities, towns, counties, adopting zoning as the central way that they would regulate the use of land within the jurisdiction. And today, zoning is very, very common. We are working to try to figure out how many communities actually did adopt zoning. Believe it or not, we don't have a number, but I have a project, the National Zoning Atlas, is trying to do that. I think it'll be most of the country. We just don't know exactly how much.
And just to take it down a level, what did that initial code in New York do, and what does zoning really do today?
So the initial code in New York City was intended to help manage development, particularly the commercial developments that were happening in this very fast-growing city, and to separate uses from each other. So you could think about zoning as being a way to, you know, at a very basic level, get factories away from office buildings, in the case of one of the first major zoning cases to make it to the Supreme Court, to get apartment buildings away from single family housing, away from, which were then away from commercial areas, and to really separate out those land uses. Early zoning, unfortunately, also had the very intentional effect of trying to segregate people based on race and economic status. So that is part of the sordid history of zoning. And unfortunately, some of that is still kind of embedded in zoning codes today, where you have a lot of types of zoning that tend to keep single family suburban style zoning all together in one place. And the language in many zoning codes is that those zones have to be protected. So, you know, zoning has, you know, started from perhaps a desire to separate uses, to some extent, a desire to separate people. It's evolved. But the point of my book is to say, look, we are where we are. Let's try to make it better using the things that we now know have been the effects of the kinds of zoning that we've practiced in most of the country.
Now, on the flip side, what happens in a place like Houston, which basically lacks any kind of zoning?
So I grew up in Houston, the only large American city without zoning, and it's a bit of a hodgepodge. It's a little disorganized. The food is great. I say that in every interview. Like, there's no better place to eat than Houston, Texas. But the architecture, the visual environment, it's a bit of a hodgepodge. When I went back to visit the apartment building I grew up in for the book, I saw, oh, across the street, there's a gas station, there's a strip mall, there's a nightclub, there's a self-storage facility. These are not great things for a child to be wandering around the neighborhood to come upon, right? A gas station's probably the most dangerous place for a child. So you can't really say that Houston was designed around quality of life. And it should be. People in Houston deserve to have neighborhoods that are sort of rationally planned. It's not something that you get, though, in a place without zoning.
And, you know, one of the things that's interesting is you mentioned that there are some racial elements to early zoning, and I want to ask about that. But there is an idealistic perspective that comes behind the reason to zone. It's what you just mentioned. There are laudatory goals associated with trying to create certain kinds of land uses. I want to ask about the sort of racial stuff, because after the Supreme Court sort of made it clear that you couldn't overtly do racial zoning policies, there were some sort of facially neutral policies that still had substantial discriminatory effects. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so you referred to this 1917 case, Buchanan versus Worley, that struck down a racially explicit zoning ordinance in Louisville, Kentucky. I mean, they wrote it right into the code. Where people could live. But, you know, even when communities didn't explicitly say, well, this is the neighborhood for white residents, this is the neighborhood for Black residents, they started to use zoning to separate out, for example, apartments from what would be called single family homes today. And the Supreme Court itself actually validated this type of approach in a case in 1926, where they called apartment buildings parasites. You had that language used by the Supreme Court. So, you know, again, you can think, okay, well, the Supreme Court justices, they're members of the quote unquote elite, you know, maybe that was just their bias. But that bias, that sort of feeling that, yes, you got to separate out the apartment buildings, that's something that has extended to today. It's not racially explicit, but oftentimes because, you know, race, ethnicity, income levels are all intermingled, it does have racially discriminatory impacts when a community completely bans apartment buildings, for example, altogether.
I want to get to sort of some of your experiences in Hartford, but I'm reading along the book, and all of a sudden there's this chapter about the block in Baltimore. Why did you feel the need to put that in, and can you explain a little bit about what the block in Baltimore tells us about how you deal with zoning problems like the sex industry?
Part of the way that I wrote this book was just, hey, the places I've been. Okay, so let me start over. I've not patronized any places on the block. let me just say that. But, you know, in walking around Baltimore, you come upon this street that's sort of all of these adult uses packed wall to wall. It's actually under the watchful eye of the police department a block over, interestingly enough. And you wonder, well, how did this happen? Well, zoning says where adult uses can go. And I really wanted to write a chapter, which I did, on nightlife and how zoning impacts bars and nightclubs and adult uses. And one of the things people should know is that cities have to allow adult uses under free speech rules. So if you go back to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court has said, hey, you got to let people freely express themselves. You've got to allow for adult uses in every community. Zoning cannot ban them all together. And so cities have taken different approaches to that. Some of them have said, okay, you've got to spread them out. They disperse them throughout the city. Others like Baltimore said, well, let's put them all in one place. And part of Baltimore's response was a response to the way that the city actually grew up historically, where you had brothels and saloons and things that were springing up in what city leaders thought were far too many neighborhoods. So they said, let's try to put it all in one place. And that's where you get this block. And again, you know, for me, looking at how some of these places, you know, just walking around cities and observing, hey, wow, that's interesting, kind of gave me a lot of the fodder for this book.
You must walk around cities and look at it very differently than most people, I would imagine. Look at what zoning mistakes they've made and such.
It's a blessing and a curse. Uh-huh. Because I'll look around a place and I'll say, wait, how did that end up there? And I will often go to the zoning code and say, oh, that's super interesting. And of course, maybe I'm the only person on the planet that does that and finds that interesting. But that is my burden and blessing, I guess, to think that way.
I want to talk, as we indicated, I want to talk a little bit about Hartford. Your views are obviously shaped by this firsthand experience you had in Hartford. Tell us a little bit about how Hartford has evolved as a city and an economy, and how the zoning practices gave you the kinds of neighborhood you saw when you first began working with the Zoning Commission.
You know, I mean, Hartford is a city that was founded as a city the way it is now in 1635. So this is a city that goes back almost 400 years and has a lot of history, a lot of neighborhoods, a lot of walkable areas, because of course the city largely developed before there were cars. One of the things that the zoning code that was last updated in the 1950s did was it turned the city's land use rules into a car oriented, it sort of harnessed them in service of the car. So you saw gas stations and car washes and fast food drive-throughs and other things being allowed throughout the city in a way that would convenience the people who drive. You saw streets getting widened, minimum parking requirements being put into place. A lot of that came from and was in tandem with the zoning code that encouraged the sort of use of cars. That's not the way that cities should be developed, especially historic cities like Hartford. And what we tried to do with our zoning code was to reverse that and make the city's zoning for people, not for cars. And there are a lot of different aspects of that, but it almost meant going back to the way the city developed before, trying to get 2-, 3-, 4-story buildings on our main streets, trying to get the kind of housing that we had before, the sort of mixed use, neighborhoods as well. And again, really thinking about the historical development of the city and how a new zoning code could help Hartford get back to its roots, frankly.
And do you see changes that have happened as a result of that zoning that sort of reflects what you guys were trying to do?
Absolutely. We have seen new kinds of development that have come about without the kinds of problematic requirements that you had before. We legalized housing as of right wherever we said it could be built. So in other words, we eliminated public hearings. So we have seen new housing go up and housing conversions that haven't had lengthy processes that can be approved by staff instead. We've seen developments go up without parking lots because again, it's a walkable city and developers will build or lease parking where they need to. But we didn't have that onerous requirement on developers. So I think over time, we will see development in Hartford that really complements its historic fabric. And I'm really hopeful that overall, the city will become the equitable, sustainable city that we hoped it would be.
You also have an interesting set of passages where you talk about San Diego and what happened with the large malls that were originally developed in San Diego. Can you sort of share a little bit about what happened there?
So San Diego, like many growing cities at the time, put a lot of their chips in the large mall basket. So they allowed for the development of suburban style malls that we've probably all been to, where you drive there, there's a vast sea of parking. You have the department store model where the department stores anchor a couple sides of the mall, the ends of the mall, and there's little shops in between. It's all internal, and you know, again, and probably don't have to spell that out for your listeners. But San Diego has kind of looked at itself and said, maybe this is not the way people want to shop anymore. You do see people gravitating towards open air environments, towards historic main streets. You see maybe less of a desire, especially in urban cities like San Diego, to just have that suburban model. And that was borne out by the fact that patronage of these malls had significantly decreased. And so the shops were declaring bankruptcy. And again, we've seen that in the news, these large department stores kind of falling out of favor. So what the city did was it rezoned these areas, which happened to be near transit stops within the city, to allow for a much wider mix of development. And with its rezoning, they've unlocked what I hope will be large-scale development of these vast seas of parking lots and outdated mall buildings for mixed-use, walkable, amenity-rich neighborhoods. Mm. Because you can build an entire neighborhood in a mall parking lot, but that are near transit and that are near water in their case. So I use it as an example to say, even in a city where you've got a lot of car, you know, San Diego still is a California city. It's a big city. You usually do need a car. They're trying something different, and they're trying it through zoning, which has then spurred on development and investment in completely new ways.
So a large aspect of the book is examining single family housing, and where large areas of cities are reserved for single family housing, which turns it almost into suburbia. But I imagine it also limits diversity and affordability. Can you tell us a little bit about that, please?
So if you have a zoning code that says you need 1 acre for a piece of land, for one house, you're going to have to build that out into farmland or maybe forest land. You're going to have to create sprawl. You're going to create a neighborhood that is not walkable, because I guess you could walk, you know, between your house and the center of a 1 acre lot to your neighbors and then to maybe the next neighbors, but you're going to get tired by the time you get to the nearest grocery store. So you're going to get in your car instead. And so we've created these single family, large lot neighborhoods that are what I would consider one size fits all zoning across the country. And we've done that to the detriment of our health, to our environment, to our landscapes. And I think ultimately even to our municipal budgets, because the more roads you build, the more a municipality has to maintain them, the more streetlights they've got to maintain. It's a much easier task to have 10 townhomes together on a 1 acre lot than 10 1 acre lots from a city management perspective. So there are a lot of dimensions to that kind of development that are problematic. And I think people should understand that zoning is what caused that.
And there's a lot of it. I mean, I think there were some statistics in the book about just how prevalent single-family, you know, housing zones are around the country. It seems to me like that it presents an enormous challenge to try to revisit that. Are cities doing that, revisiting the single-family?
You do see cities around the country that have looked at their zoning codes and said, maybe we need to at least allow accessory dwellings on single family lots, which is like a granny flat or an in-law suite. Some have said, well, maybe we should allow for subdivision to two families. Maybe we should allow for a single family to be converted into a duplex. So they are looking at that. You have some cities that have gone as far as Minneapolis and other places that have said, well, you can build up to 4 units in a single family zone. Now, these are new things for many communities. We are seeing more of that interest and inquiry, and I hope that we continue to, because again, there are lots of people who do not necessarily want to live on a large lot anymore. And so what do you do with these large lots? In some cases, you got to figure out how to get more units in the same amount of land, because that land is what's expensive.
So there's actually more environmental sustainability involved in rezoning these 1 acre suburbia style neighborhoods in larger cities.
It can be done, but it's a process. So I do think, though, more cities are actually considering this, and you're also seeing some activity at the state level as well.
And of course, anytime you try to do something like that, you run into lots of legal challenges, I assume.
You sure do. Minneapolis is getting sued. Something that I footnoted in the book somewhere, you know.
Yeah.
this happened, but it is in progress. So
we get to the end of the book, and I guess my question for you is, what, as a practical matter, do you think should be happening going forward, and how likely is it to happen? If you could take control of this thing, how would you sort of advise cities to change things?
Well, I think the first step is for people to understand that there is a thing called zoning and it impacts on the way we live. And that's step one. That's my book. That's what that's trying to do. It's not just housing, it's nightlife, like we talked about, it's small businesses, it's the environment and so on. Next step, though, is to take that information to be able to engage in conversations at the local level. Raise your hand and say, hey, I'm interested in this. Join a zoning commission even, but you know, just at a minimum, attend a meeting, talk to elected officials about zoning, especially inquiring with the National Zoning Atlas to see whether your town is up on the zoning atlas at zoningatlas.org, and you can easily compare your town to a neighboring town.
Now, I know here in Utah, Salt Lake City especially, they're starting to do some allowance of ADUs, as we just mentioned. Have you explored Salt Lake or any other areas of Utah?
Absolutely. So Utah is really interesting because they have started to do work at the state level to try to give municipalities a menu of options to choose different kinds of zoning strategies. So if you look at Salt Lake City, we have a number of Utah, about 30 jurisdictions in Utah up on Zoning Atlas. Salt Lake City is pretty interesting because a lot of the land actually does allow for apartments. It's not just a single family only city. By contrast, if you look outside of Salt Lake City, if you look at, let's say, I don't know, West Valley City, West Jordan, I mean, that some of these towns that you may be more familiar with, you see a lot of single family zoning and you see very little zoning for apartment buildings. This is a pattern that we see in cities across the country where you see the city itself, the big city, will allow for lots of apartments. But then the suburban towns, the more outlying areas, they will not allow for as much. And from a regional development perspective, from a housing perspective, from an access to schools and jobs perspective, you wonder whether that's the best we can do. So yes, I mean, Utah is interesting. There's a lot going on there from a zoning standpoint and zoning conversations. I hope some of your listeners check out the Zoning Atlas and get involved. But I don't think the conversation is over there by any means.
Okay. We've been talking to Sarah Bronin about her new book, Key to the City, How Zoning Shapes Our World. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks, Roger. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Hey, and real quick, how can our listeners get a peek at the Zoning Atlas?
So you can link to it from my website at sarabronin.com, or you can go to zoningatlas.org and... You know, either way, hope you enjoy learning more about zoning.
Absolutely. There are a variety of gyms and fitness centers to choose from in the Park City area. Rise Boxing is one of those many specialty facilities. The boxing and other martial arts classes offered there don't stop with just hitting or kicking a bag. If you want to get in the ring with an opponent, that's an option. But there's a class that really caught our attention. Mary Gwen Valenga created Rise to have a space to train in fighting arts. We are lucky to be joined by her this morning. Good morning, Mary Gwen.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. So did I get that correct? Rise is a gym for training, and if desired, one can jump into the ring or onto the mat to compete?
Yes, that's right. Yep.
So tell us a little bit about the, you know, sort of the overall picture of the gym. Do you have, what kind of classes do you offer?
Sure. So, you know, originally the model was sort of built around wanting to have a competitive fight program. However, I knew that would be challenging in Park City, and I think, quite frankly, it's challenging in any city. So I wanted to create a fitness program that used the training modalities of boxing. And, you know, over the years, I've seen through my own training experience at every gym, a very small fraction of people actually compete, and taking boxing to the broader masses without that expectation of competing was something that I really wanted to do and show what the benefits were without that as an option.
So you talk about the benefits. Talk a little bit about the training regimen that is associated with boxing that people find helpful.
Sure, yeah. So boxing is one of the highest cardio outputs. We're using both the anaerobic and the aerobic system. So we're working in short durations of 3-minute windows with high intensity bursts within that 3-minute window. We're doing everything from working on the bag, doing body weight conditioning, strength training with weights, a lot of footwork, a lot of balance based moves, agility, kind of everything you would expect in a traditional boxing gym.
Nice. And so do you compete yourself?
I do, yeah.
For how long have you been competing?
I have been competing since 2010, so 14 years.
Wow.
Yeah, I had 57 amateur fights and now 11 pro fights.
Describe, one of the things I really love about the shows we get to do is this is a country of multiple subcultures, right? And you just don't know what people are into. The idea that there's a large women's boxing network, women's fighting network, is not something that I knew. Talk to us a little bit about how it's organized, and when you say amateur and professional, what kind of fights are they?
Sure. So the amateur scene is governed by regional bodies underneath the USA boxing system. Utah has a governing body. There are sanctioned bouts underneath the USA boxing umbrella almost every weekend. Gyms turn in a list of fighters. It's just like any other sport, right? And amateur fights are happening regularly around the state. There's a feeding mechanism into regional tournaments that then feed the national tournament, which puts you on Team USA, which is the feeder system for the Olympics. Once you kind of elect to transition into the professional ranks, then you're working one-on-one with a manager or a promoter, and then you're kind of at the duress of finding fights on your own and building your career based off of your performance at that level.
Outstanding. Holy cow. And so you were competing, and you built Rise for a place to train. How long has Rise been over there on Rasmussen?
6.5 years. We opened May 2018.
And it's been successful.
It has.
Both as a business and a place for you to train. And I assume some other fighters you know in the area can train there as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so are you still active professionally?
As you guys have seen, as I walked in, I'm on crutches right now. So
I
right
mean
now,
literally this week. But
taking a little break. But yeah, I had last competed in the spring of this year and plan to get back to it. If all things go as planned.
Now, we're a money show, so I have to ask you, what kind of money is there on the professional boxing scene?
So this is fascinating to me. You know, women's boxing became an Olympic sport in 2012. We've seen massive growth in it. The first $1 million payday was, I believe, 2 years ago. And just yesterday I read that we will have, it's like the biggest payday is $6.1 million for a woman. So it's growing quickly, but still levels below where the men are, right? But you know, in professional boxing, it's like many things, the majority of people are making probably $10,000 or less. And, you know, unless you're fighting for a world title fight, you're probably not making more than six figures.
So for there to be a $6 million purse, there's got to be media. So clearly there's got to be more. It's being picked up. Is it, you know, getting national coverage like on at networks like ESPN or
Correct.
HBO?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
yep.
Have you been on a televised fight?
I have, yeah. I fought on ESPN, yeah.
Yep. Okay.
I can't even imagine that. Can't even imagine. So now I'm going to spin it to the specialty class that you have over there. And it is for men and women with Parkinson's.
Correct, yep.
How does that work?
Or how did that come about?
Yeah, so I had been approached about it years ago. I didn't know enough about Parkinson's to feel like it was something I was confident in. I had kind of heard there's a program called Rock Steady that is a boxing program developed for people with Parkinson's, but I didn't really feel like it was anything that I had any business coaching, to be honest. And then a few years later, somebody else came and approached me about it. And I, at that point, my coaching had grown significantly. I was on the board of directors for the local boxing committee. And I think that just my confidence in my ability to learn it and where I was at had shifted. We did a 2-month pilot program with a handful of the folks who had approached me. I worked closely with a doctor in Washington State and then also became connected with a doctor at the University of Utah, Dr. Lamont, and then developed this program. And we've been rolling now for over a year and a half. It's been incredible.
And how's the turnout?
It's great. I have the most consistent athletes in that program, and that is awesome. I think that one of the things that happens is when you realize how much it benefits you, you become committed to it, right? You see the benefits, and for the Parkinson's folks, they're having better outcomes, better performance, and better, you know, they feel better the day they train. So I think there's two components. There's a short-term benefit that they're experiencing within the afternoon after training, but then there's the long-term benefits of a prolonged athletic program. They're seeing those benefits more like 6 months down the road. But I think that the consistency from that group comes from seeing the results in real time.
So what kind of curriculum is offered to the Parkinson's patients who are coming to your classes? What are they doing?
Yeah, so they're on the bag for about a third of class. Then they do partner work. So we're honing kind of reflex-based work, right? We aren't in the boxing, in the Parkinson's class, it's all no contact. So we're either catching punches with our hands, mm-hmm. with our gloves on, or using paddles or mitts. Then we are doing either a balance-based, an agility-based, or a strength-based conditioning program on the back end.
And so I assume that slows the progression of the disease, you know, the long-term.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's, yeah. That's right.
And that's a medically proven, this is fat. I mean, I know a few people with Parkinson's and I have to get them over there to check it out. It sounds phenomenal.
Yeah, you know, I will say that in my conversations with Dr. Lamont and some of the other professionals, I think that the jury is still out about whether boxing or, you know, ballroom dancing is another popular modality for training for Parkinson's folks. And I think the jury is out about whether boxing is the magic or whether simply exercise and training is. My personal opinion, and this comes from coaching kids, people with disabilities, adults, everybody in between, is that skill-based exercise has a bigger impact, right? And I think that the learning component is improving the plasticity of the brain, and you know, it is creating something beyond just an elevated heart rate. And you kind of see that cognitive functioning improve amongst all people, not just the Parkinson's folk. And again, I'm not a doctor, I just get to try things and see the results. So
then how many days a week do you have a class for Parkinson's?
We train Monday, Wednesday, Friday from 11 to 12, so 3 days a week.
And your athletes come all 3 days?
Pretty consistently, yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's talk about other kinds of classes that you offer. You mentioned kids.
Yeah.
What ages do you start seeing kids, and what are the kinds of classes you offer for them?
Sure, we have a kids boxing program for kids 6 to 12. Under the USA boxing system, kids compete at age 8. So we start at 6 to give them a couple of years to get familiar with the sport. I know 8 seems pretty young, doesn't it? And then we transition our more advanced youth into our competition team, and we train anybody 6 years and older.
Well, I found myself competing in amateur boxing at 8 in the schoolyard, and it wasn't very organized. Can you talk a little bit about and I wasn't very good at it, but can you talk a little bit about what you do with kids of that age?
Yeah, you know, it's really the same thing if you're a 6-year-old or a 65-year-old or a 26-year-old. We are kind of doing the same thing. We are moving from really slow skill-based progression, right? Going over what are the techniques of the punches and then doing almost choreographed sequences. So building offense, defense, action, reaction drills. I throw the jab, you react by parrying it and coming over the top with a 2-3-2, for example, so that people are getting the very specific offense and defense. And then we move to the bag, and on the bag, you get to up the intensity and kind of work on your own a little bit more. And then we're doing the same footwork drills, conditioning and strength training. Kids are doing a little bit less strength training and a little bit more gameplay. We play dodgeball every day in the kids' class, of course, gotta have some fun. But the classes are very similar based on the age with, I would say, the coaching a little bit more tailored to each subtype.
Good. And where are you located exactly?
We are on Rasmussen Road between Kimball Junction and Jeremy Ranch in the same plaza that Burt Brothers is in.
Gotcha. And your website is?
Is riseboxing.com.
So kids and adults can all find you right there.
Yep.
You know, if someone was listening to this and had a kid who was 8, 9, 10 years old, they might be worried about safety. Talk to us a little bit about how you protect these kids while they're trying to learn to box.
Yeah, so one of the things that I stress is there's a saying in boxing that you don't play boxing, meaning that I don't give you the basketball and you go play the game, right? Yes. It's a very detail-oriented, skill-based sport with consequences, right? And so we are really prioritizing teaching the proper technique and moving from a safe progression into contact, right? But like anything, if you have the skills to defend properly, it's a pretty safe sport. Like I said, I've had, 65 plus fights, and I've never been injured really in the ring. I had one little head clash, but I accredit that to focusing as much on my defense and my footwork and being evasive in the ring. And that's the style that I like to teach. But also, there's a ton of data and research out there showing that many other contact sports, hockey, soccer, football, have higher concussions. And I think it, like anything, if we do it safely and we honor the progression properly, it can be a really safe sport.
Do your students wear headgear?
Yeah, they okay. do. Yeah.
All the way through? I mean, even your adults?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So that does help on the concussion front.
It does. Yeah. Yeah.
So the amateur fights, they're wearing headgear.
Correct.
And then once you go pro, you're not wearing a headgear.
Yeah, that's right.
Good. Now, I'm going to completely go a different direction.
Sure.
So there's a lot of movies out there have boxing. You know, we all know Rocky. Can you name a movie, a recent, you know, back to Rocky, that showed boxing properly? And then maybe a movie that just had nothing to do with boxing. The movie was about boxing, but they didn't know what they were doing.
Oh, those are great questions. And I'm not a huge movie buff, so okay. Those might be tricky. But I think, the Creed movies are the sequence of the Rockies, right? Mm-hmm. And I do think the last Creed movie, they brought in a really good team of people from within the boxing world. And I think they represented the sport well. One of the things that I've wanted to show this community is the sportsmanship and the camaraderie and the kindness that exists in the sport, because I think we often get a bad rap, and I think that movie did a good job of expressing some of those things.
And did that movie increase business for you? Yeah, did people get more interested in boxing?
You know who's increased business for us, I think, is Jake Paul. Are you guys familiar with Jake Paul?
No.
He was a Nintendo kid coming up, but he's a YouTuber who has really massively impacted the scene. He's doing these, super fights with non-traditional boxers and YouTube stars. But we need it coming into the public space, and he's doing that, and I give him a little credit for that, I guess.
Yet another subculture I wasn't aware of. Go ahead, Kevin.
Yeah, right.
YouTuber turned boxer.
Yes, sir.
Fantastic, fantastic. Well, excellent. We've just spent a few minutes here with Mary Gwen Valenga of Rise Boxing. Again, it's www.riseboxing.com. They're down there on Rasmussen between Kimball Junction and Jeremy Ranch, Pine Brook. Mary Gwen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank
Anything
you so much.
Anything else you want to share with our listeners?
No, that's it.
Beautiful.
Come on in. Thank you so much.
Americans love to spend money on things. Toys. Not necessarily PlayStation or Transformers, but adult toys. Well, not that kind of adult toy. We're talking about boats, UTVs, jet skis, RVs, dirt bikes, etc. And all those toys need a place to be kept. We're joined by Robert Holmes and Drew Munson, both in the world of self-storage. Good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for being here.
Excellent. Robert, I'm going to start with you, if that's cool. What do you and Park City Self-Storage do?
Well, we offer self-storage, typical drive-up self-storage. We also have temperature-controlled storage. We have a multi-level facility with lots of temperature-controlled storage, and then just your traditional drive-up storage that you see everywhere.
Excellent. And where is Park City Self-Storage?
So it's in the Silver Creek Business Park, which is kind of just north of Home Depot.
Okay. Yep. Know that. And how long have you been there?
We opened in June of 2009.
Wow. That's a long time.
Yes.
And was there already a facility there, or did you build it from scratch?
No, we built it from scratch. Yep.
And how many spaces?
Oh, 730.
730 different spaces.
Units. And then we have 80 parking spots.
Wow.
For RVs and boats that are outdoor, uncovered.
And are you typically full?
About 94-95% typically.
I think that's considered full.
Yeah. It's maybe over full by industry standards.
Right.
I think a lot of the industry likes to be around 90%, just so there's always something available for new customers at a higher rate.
Right. And Drew, Aberdeen Management and Development, what is it and what do you do there?
So we're a family organization, We're a family organization. We manage and develop storage facilities. We're primarily in Arizona at this time. And that's what we do. We do typically we identify, develop, lease up, and self-manage facilities. We have 9 facilities, currently about 975,000 square feet, all in Arizona.
975,000 square feet. Whole. Go ahead. Sorry,
okay.
Roger.
So let's talk a little bit about who the industry caters to, and from a big picture, who are the people that are renting these storage units and why do they need them? Robert?
Well, for us, we see a lot of homeowners that need an extension of their home for storage. They don't have, especially for instance, the homeowners in Old Town, the houses just don't have storage. So they're using our facility and other facilities around. Obviously, we have competition to store their bikes and their patio furniture and their winter tires and whatever they can't put in their home. But we also get a lot of customers that are remodeling homes that need to get all their stuff out of their house while they're remodeling or during construction. So we cater to a lot of different people, but we do have quite a big customer base of just people storing toys, ATVs, kayaks, stand-up paddle boards, all that stuff.
That COVID money was nice to all of us.
Yes.
Now, how many people are long-term compared to remodelers that are short-term, 6-12 months?
It's, our average stay is about 14 months. I think the industry is about 12 months. So we're a little longer than that, but I have customers that have been in there since the first month we opened.
And how are things different in Arizona, Drew?
That's about the same for us as well. I think the industry average is kind of 8-12 months, but our average is over a year. People are typically storing stuff, household items, furniture, things like that. Moving is a big source of demand. It's about 35-40% industry-wide. It may be a little bit different in different markets. But a lot of it, about 35-40% is excess stuff. We saw the COVID boom or COVID bump occur. And what happened is, a lot of people started working from home and they needed to clear out their garage and their house. And so the industry saw kind of unprecedented occupancy and rates. And I don't know if that reflects over here in Park City as well. But that's sort of over now. But, that's how it was in Arizona for us.
So I'm visualizing like a graph that has a certain percentage of people, they're moving. It's a short-term thing. It's an 3-month, 6-month, 8-month thing. But then there's a certain part of that graph where people fall into the trap, if you will, of I've moved the stuff out, it's in the storage unit, I just don't want to deal with it, and it just sits there and accumulates charges. I mean, is that a realistic perspective of a significant number of people?
Absolutely. I mean, people just have it on auto pay on their, on their credit cards, and they just kind of forget about it. I, all the time when people move out, I congratulate them. I'm like, congratulations, I'm getting your stuff out.
Do people have yard sales inside the storage bin so they don't have to move?
For a number of years, we actually offered that for our customers. We would advertise a day, and they could bring their stuff out of their units, and we would have the public open it to the public and have them come in and sell it. It got to where COVID hit, and we stopped doing it, but it was well received. We might start it back up.
Good. So let's start with Drew. What are the biggest challenges that you find in this business?
Well, there's operational challenges. We've had some issues. We have a couple of climate-controlled facilities, and there's a homeless issue that, an unhoused issue that we struggle with sometimes. People try to use it as apartments, so, we have to stay on top of that. That's obviously a violation of the lease. As far as dynamics in the market now, it seems to be at a bit of an inflection point where, in our facilities, we compete with the REITs. The REITs and the public companies quite a bit. And pricing has become very aggressive. Occupancy has become a struggle. There's been a lot of new supply, especially in markets like Phoenix and, a lot of these Sunbelt markets. And so we've been struggling with rates and supply and, trying to entice people to use our product.
Yeah. Robert?
Our biggest challenge, historically, has been employees, trying to find help. We have a great staff right now, but that's always been a challenge. Fortunately, we don't have the homeless issue here in Park City as far as trying to stay in storage, or we don't have. I've had one person over the years try to stay in one of the units overnight, and we've quickly figured that out and asked him to leave. But we don't have those issues. I rarely do an auction. Maybe once a year. I'm sure your situation is probably different.
And when you say an auction?
So when someone is delinquent, over time, you're allowed to auction off the contents of the storage unit to recoup your costs. Each state has different ways of doing it. So I won't speak for Arizona, but it's a whole process.
Gotcha. What is the process? I mean, I think I've seen things in the park record notices that someone's auctioning off a storage unit.
Yeah, so when they're delinquent a certain amount of time, you have to give them notice, and then you have to post notice publicly when you're going to have the auction. Obviously, that person can actually even come to the auction and buy their stuff back if so be. But we don't have it happen here very often. Maybe you could speak to how your process works, and because you probably do it more often than we do.
Yeah, so we run them on a pretty regular basis. We actually post them online. Our objective is always to really get our tenants' goods back to them. So we'll make a deal with them. We don't like taking things to auction. I think there's an impression that that storage facilities make all this money on the auctions. Like Robert was saying, that's not the case. We have a lien on the balance of our unit, not on the value of the contents. And so sometimes on the very rare occasion where we get more than our lien is for, we actually cut a check and send it back to the tenant. And so we have them every, kind of on a rolling basis. But it's something that we try to work out a deal with the tenants.
So the people who show up at the auction, do they know what they're trying to buy? Or is it like a grab bag?
So in Utah, we open the door to the storage unit, and they can look. They can't go in. Mm-hmm. They can't touch anything. They all have flashlights. They're all looking. And they try and figure out what it's worth, and then they start bidding. It's the same group of people that come through. Usually, and they've got a whole business model of how they sell this stuff online or eBay or whatever they use, and they're into it.
Yet another subculture.
Yeah. Wow. For finding a metal.
It's the theme of the day. Or...
That's today's. Yep.
Okay, so it's the same people that you see. Now, I've been waiting to ask this all morning. What is the weirdest or thing that you have ever found in an abandoned unit, Drew?
So we're fortunate to not have found many strange things.
No dead bodies
nothing like that. We've had a few. We had a facility about a mile from the border in Arizona. We had a call from the ATF one day. That was fun. We don't know what was in that unit, but interesting things.
The ATF came and raided the unit.
Correct. We had one that was full of tequila again at the one, at the facility by the border. We had a broken plane in one that I was talking to you earlier about. Some classic cars that typically, those things, we work out a deal. We track down the owner and get those items back to them. Things like things like that. I don't know. Do you?
What about you, Robert?
Yeah, not a lot of odd things. We've had some cars for sure. Actually, the sheriff's department uses our facility for their dogs. They'll put stuff in empty units and then train their dogs down the hallways to find drugs and that type of thing. So it's a good training area for them. They usually maybe once a year they'll come out and do some training.
When you started that, I was kind of nervous they were using your storage facility for kennels, but no.
No, for drug dog training. And I think explosives, too.
What do people rent climate-controlled units for? You think of the traditional storage unit, mostly it's a drive-up. Sometimes people put their car, their boat. But a climate-controlled unit you probably can't drive to, right? I assume they're multi-level. What do people use those for?
Well, so yeah, we have elevators that go up and down. We actually have a basement, a subterranean level. We actually have a lot of wine storage that people have put in. But, you know, art, wine, I guess document storage, that, you know, just things that are, you know, delicate to temperature changes.
And the climate controlled units are the ones inside the big building at your place.
Correct.
And then non-climate controlled on
Correct.
The outside.
Correct. That's right.
And go ahead.
I was going to say, has the ratio of demand, and this is really for you more, Drew, the ratio of demand for climate controlled versus non-climate controlled changed? I suppose in Phoenix, there's a whole different element, because I imagine a non-climate controlled unit in Phoenix would be really hard on stuff.
Yeah, so it's a relatively, I'd congratulate you, Robert, you're pretty ahead of the curve in 2009. It's a relatively new product. And so there's more and more of it out there. I'm not sure, but probably kind of 30% to 40%. And a lot of the new developments have gone climate controlled because of land constraints and construction costs and the rate that you need to get to make these things work. But yeah, people like it. You know, they like storing their valuable furniture, their art, and their different things like that. And so we found that there's a pretty steady demand for about 40%. But people still do like the drive ups, you know, kind of the garage space for big bulky items. And so it's just sort of different products for different
needs. So when you're building new units, you're building more of the climate control.
And climate control is relative to where you are. I mean, like in Louisiana, they're doing humidity control. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't air condition our units because it doesn't really get that hot, but we do heat them in the winter. So that's really the only climate control we're offering now. In Arizona, I'm sure you're air conditioning and maybe even doing humidity, and probably not humidity, but...
Yeah, we're the opposite. We have a heat pump. We use the AC. We very rarely crank on the heat in Arizona.
Okay. We should probably wrap this up. We've been speaking with Drew of Aberdeen Management and Robert of Park City Storage. Gentlemen, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Enjoy. Okay, thank you very much. So, yeah, we had a great time there with learning about storage. Earlier that, we learned about Rise Boxing and then, of course, zoning across the world. So big thanks to everyone there, Sarah Bronin, Mary Gwen Valenga, Robert Holmes, and Drew Munson. If you have any ideas on something that we should cover, send us an email, mountainmoney@kpcw.org.
You've been listening to Mountain Money on KPCW.